Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
So, Steve, did Ava Gardner and Howard Hughes have a good relationship?
Well, they did, until he dislocated her jaw.
What?
Well, don't worry. She hit him back with an ashtray.
From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a PhD holding historian, a professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that makes legit, seriously researched American history come to life through entertaining stories. Join me for a chronological telling of the United States story, from the Revolution to fractious Civil War, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way from 1776 to the early 20th century. Listen to History That Doesn't Suck on Spotify.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast. A happy Thanksgiving weekend to all of my American listeners and listeners who celebrate Thanksgiving around the world or just appreciate the sentiment of it, if nothing else. Thank you very much. A quick reminder, I appreciate so much all of the iTunes ratings and reviews. If you haven't yet had a chance to do it, I would love it if you wouldn't mind going into iTunes, if that is the platform that you use to listen to your podcasts anyway, and throw me a handful of stars and a comment if you feel moved to leave one. Likewise, if you listen to Most Notorious on another platform and they have a place to leave ratings or reviews, I would appreciate that too. Thank you very much. All right, on to the show. It is great to have Samuel Dolan with me. He is a documentary writer, director, and Emmy Award-winning producer. He's produced dozens of programs for the History Channel, Military Channel, and National Geographic. He is also an author and here today to talk about his new book, Cowboys and Gangsters, Stories of an Untamed Wild West. Thanks so much for coming on.
Well, thank you, Eric. I'm happy to be here.
So what motivated you to write a book about Prohibition-era gangsters in the American Southwest?
Well, I'll try to give you a fairly succinct answer to that. I come from Arizona. I grew up there. I've always loved the history of the American Southwest. I guess you could say my love of history sort of, you know, led to my career in documentary television. And over the years, you know, I worked on a lot of different shows for History Channel and other networks. And there was content that I would try to pitch for TV shows, but it kind of fell outside of the norm. You know, when they make TV shows about the Wild West, it tends to be, you know, about Billy the Kid or Wyatt Earp and stories from the 1880s that most people have heard of. Events on the borderlands in the early 20th century, that kind of falls outside of the, you know, the greatest hits of American history, so to speak. So I had these ideas sitting around, and it wasn't going to go anywhere as far as a documentary was concerned or a TV show. So I decided, well, what the hell, I'll just write a book. I mean, it took a bit of work to get it off the ground, obviously. And I had never written a book before. I'd written a lot of TV shows, but it's a much different process. I was very fortunate that I had some good friends and mentors that were authors, nonfiction authors, and they helped give me a lot of guidance along the way. But it was sort of something I had to figure out how to do while I was doing it. I worked up the proposal and took it to Two Dot Books, and they were excited about the idea. 2 years later, there was a book. But these were stories that I found fascinating because they did not occur in the 19th century. And they weren't part of the typical story of the Roaring Twenties, which is a very urban story in the minds of a lot of Americans. It's a New York story. It's a Chicago story. Well, because of those things, most of these events had never been covered before, either in books or TV shows, movies, what have you. So there was a lot of exciting, fresh research to get started with. But I was really happy to share some of these stories with readers because it was new ground. It wasn't the story of Wyatt Earp that had been told so many times.
Yeah, that's part of what makes this book so interesting, is that you've combined two different genres and kind of smashed them together. Old West style lawmen and Prohibition era gangsters. It's the 1920s, so the West had changed pretty dramatically from the height of the Western gunfighter. What was that like, writing about two distinct eras that kind of pushed up together?
Well, I can tell you where I started. And this story, you know, is in the introduction for the book. But, you know, I grew up in the Verde Valley in northern Arizona, and you had a lot of mining towns in that region. And the stories of the Old West are all over that part of the state. But when I was a kid, my dad used to take me to this little restaurant town of Clarkdale, Arizona. And Clarkdale's an old mining town from the copper mining days. It's not an active mining town anymore, but it's a really neat little community near Jerome, Arizona. Anyways, I had heard this story all these years when I was a kid growing up about an old lawman named Jim Roberts. And Roberts was in his 60s. He was an old-timer from the Arizona Range War days in Pleasant Valley. He'd been a lawman for many years. One of these guys that had started out his career on horseback. And by the late 1920s, he's an old man. He's living in Clarkdale. He's got a commission as a deputy sheriff. And he walks his beat in town. And in June of 1928, these two young hoodlums rob the bank in town. And it's Jim Roberts with his old Colt 45 that shoots one of the bandits as they're getting away in a Chrysler and arrests the other guy. And so here is this collision between the Old West and an automobile gang from the 1920s. And I was always fascinated by that concept. And as a young person, I always loved movies like The Wild Bunch, the Peckinpah film, and The Professionals with Lee Marvin. You know, Westerns that took place during that later time period that really showcased sort of the end of the West, but this sort of collision of what we think of as the Wild West with this later period of time. And I think the shootout with Jim Roberts and Clarkdale sort of says it all. Here's a man of the frontier who, you know, is getting well up in years, and he's shooting it out with two guys who are in their late 20s, and they're trying to get away in a Chrysler. And, you know, they'd planned this robbery for several weeks. They'd cased the bank in Clarkdale and other places around the Verde Valley, but they hadn't really factored Jim Roberts into their equation. You know, Roberts with an old Colt 45 in his pocket. I always thought that was such a great story. And I use it as the introduction for the book because I think it sort of sets the tone for the bulk of the stories that I showcase. A lot of them involve lawmen, and they weren't all old men necessarily, but they were products of Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, and it was a hard life still. The West had changed. There was electricity, telephones. Many of these towns had movie theaters that were already showing silent movies that sort of showcased the mythical West. And yet, that region, the American Southwest, the borderlands, is still a very wild place. The Mexican Revolution had sort of prolonged the Wild West in that part of the world. You had a lot of labor disputes in the mining towns that turned violent. And then you had Prohibition, which in the case of Arizona begins in 1915 and in Texas in 1918 with state prohibition laws. And then all the liquor policies that came up during World War I and then into the 20s, obviously, with the 18th Amendment. And so you had lawmen who had first pinned on their badges in the 1890s and early 1900s, when it really was the Wild West, as we often think of it. They're still working in the 1920s. They're still on the job, and now they have to sort of go up against bootleggers and bank robbers and automobiles and other violent criminals. So there was this slew of stories to choose from and to draw from. And it was still a very wild place. It was superficially tame, but there was a lot of things that had sort of prolonged the turmoil of that region. The Mexican Revolution was one of those things. You know, that's a big conflict. Nearly a million people died in Mexico during a 10-year period of time. And that conflict often spilled across the border into Arizona and New Mexico and Texas. And there was a lot of racial conflict in these border towns as a result. And so you sort of had a recipe for violence, unfortunately, between the anguish of the revolution and prohibition.
So were the bootleggers operating in the area, were they homegrown, or were they coming from cities in the eastern part of the United States?
Well, you know, there's that Walter Hill film from the 1990s, Last Man Standing, and it's a story where you have this western town that's been taken over by back east gangsters, and it would be tempting to think that that's the way it really was. The truth is, most of the bootleggers were homegrown. These were Texans, Arizonans, people from New Mexico and California. They were taking advantage of the situation, the law, and the chaos at the time. You know, you had an oil boom in Texas during the same period of time. And these oil towns like Wink and Borger, those towns were wild places. They were like the boom towns of, you know, the gold rush. And you had a lot of clubs and saloons in those towns, and they needed booze. And that booze was coming from Mexico. It wasn't coming from Canada or from overseas. You know, just before, the deadline of January 16th, 1920, when Prohibition took effect, a lot of distilleries and breweries had shipped large amounts of liquor across the border into warehouses in Mexico. And that liquor, as time went by, gradually started to make its way back north across the border in the hands of bootleggers and smugglers, who then, you know, loaded it onto trucks that were driven by other men and taken to places like Albuquerque and Phoenix and Tucson, cities in the Texas interior, where it was distributed either to, you know, oil towns and mining towns or to other distributors who took it to, you know, places like St. Louis, and maybe it made its way to, you know, more organized criminal syndicates in larger cities. But for the most part, your smugglers coming out of Mexico were Mexican smugglers. And these were some hard guys. A lot of them had fought in the Mexican Revolution. They were seasoned combat veterans of that struggle. And a lot of them had an animosity towards the American lawmen. You know, there had been a number of really violent episodes during the Mexican Revolution years where most notably, some Texas Rangers had murdered Mexican Americans in South Texas. And so there was this animosity, this lingering tension. And so these Mexican smugglers thought nothing of engaging in gunfights with American lawmen. There was no extradition treaty in place. So they'd have a gunfight. They may lose their shipment of booze, but they'd have a gunfight and they'd quickly slip back across the border and they'd never be arrested. Most of the lawmen that were killed in the border states in the 1920s, those crimes went unavenged. Criminals were never brought to justice.
So what were the most active areas? Where was most of this action happening?
Well, as far as bootlegging was concerned, El Paso was sort of ground zero for that activity. El Paso was the largest city on the Mexican border at the time. It sat directly opposite Juarez, which was the largest city in northern Mexico, intersection of all these railroads. Juarez was the place where a lot of these warehouses where liquor was being stored were located. It was very easy for these bootleggers to transport liquor across the river, across the Rio Grande, into El Paso or the areas outside of El Paso, where it would be loaded into cars and trucks and taken north. The boundary, the border at the time, you know, we talk about a wall being built and all these things. There was nothing like that back then. The only thing you had that marked the Mexican border were a series of stone monuments that ran along the land border. And then, of course, the Rio Grande once you get to Texas. Otherwise, there was nothing to mark the border. And the American lawmen that guarded the border, and this was before the modern-day Border Patrol was organized in 1924, you know, it was really thinly guarded by customs inspectors, prohibition agents, and so on. And so it was no difficult task to transport liquor across the border. And El Paso became sort of a hub for this activity, and then as a result, it became a setting for a lot of gunfights.
A lot of the gangsters whose names we're more familiar with, the lawmen who were pursuing them, didn't match up with them weapons-wise, equipment-wise. Was it the same in the Southwest? What kind of weapons were these guys packing? What did the lawmen from this part of the country have to deal with?
Well, most of your smugglers, particularly your Mexican smugglers, they were carrying the weapons that had got them through the Mexican Revolution. The German Mauser, a lot of Winchesters, revolvers of various types, semi-automatic handguns. They were pretty well armed in a sense. Tommy guns and other automatic weapons, they didn't really come into play early on. Sort of towards the end of the Prohibition era, there was a bit more of that. But for the most part, the Mexican smugglers were using, you know, the weapons of the Mexican Revolution. On the lawman side of the equation, most officers were still carrying the guns that were holdovers from the Old West, Winchester lever actions, Colt single action revolvers, and then sort of an influx of early semi-automatic, handguns and rifles like the 351 Winchester, which was a little rapid fire carbine that was pretty popular. I would say they were pretty evenly matched in a sense. You know, it's often been talked about how, particularly as you got up into the 30s, you know, Bonnie and Clyde and people like that would sort of outgun the lawmen that they were going up against. Well, Texas Rangers in particular and other border lawmen were pretty well heeled, to use that Old West expression, and pretty well armed. But like I said, they're dealing with smugglers who were, a lot of these were professional soldiers. They'd ridden with Pancho Villa or in one of the other revolutionary armies. And they cut their teeth on a, you know, on a Mauser rifle or a 30-30 Winchester. These guys were pretty heavy-duty fighters.
Did Hoover and the FBI spend time, resources in the Southwest, or did they leave law enforcement to the locals?
You know, the FBI in the 1920s, at least as far as the Mexican border was concerned, you know, where they had a presence in cities like El Paso, their main focus was on what they called subversives. They were more concerned with anarchists and labor movements and spies, you know, during the Mexican Revolution years. The role of enforcing customs laws and dealing with bootleggers really fell on the shoulders of the Prohibition Service, you know, the federal prohibition agents who work for the Treasury, and your customs service agents, your mounted customs inspectors, sort of the forerunners of the U.S. Border Patrol. It was really their job to combat the smuggling and the gangsters on the Mexican border. The FBI, you know, Hoover had mixed feelings about prohibition enforcement, and he particularly had mixed feelings about the officers of the Prohibition Service. You know, prohibition agents, as it's been also depicted in Hollywood, you know, you had good prohibition agents, but there was quite a bit of corruption in that bureau from the very beginning. And Hoover had concerns about prohibition agents sort of tainting, as you get into the early 30s, tainting the FBI as he was starting to build it up. He was less interested in prohibition enforcement. So the FBI wasn't quite as involved in combating these gangs. It became the job of prohibition agents and narcotics agents, mounted customs inspectors, and then from 1924 onward, the U.S. Border Patrol. You know, the Border Patrol was organized to enforce immigration laws, particularly the really unfortunate laws that prohibited the entry of Asian immigrants to the United States. But as any of the old border patrolmen would tell you, they spent basically the first decade of their existence dealing with bootleggers in Texas and in Arizona.
Can you talk a bit about some of your favorite characters in this book, who are some of the personalities that especially stick with you?
Well, one particularly colorful lawman is a guy named Joe Hardwick, who was a lawman in Arizona in the 19-teens and early 1920s. He had a sort of checkered background, the kind of background that nowadays you could never become a policeman with this sort of background. He'd been in prison in Oklahoma for manslaughter for several years, gotten a pardon, and then went to Arizona, was engaged in ranching, shot somebody in 1917, got a little bit of attention because of that, went to work for the Bisbee Police Force in Bisbee, Arizona, down near the Mexican border, and then became a deputy sheriff in Cochise County, participated in a number of gunfights, went on to Pinal County, Arizona, was in a shootout there in the early 20s, and then he moved on to California, became the chief of police in Calexico, California, and really earned a dubious reputation there for a lot of shootouts and things he was involved in. Eventually shot the wrong man and went to trial for that and spent some time in prison. But Joe Hardwick is a really interesting guy. He was really a throwback. I mean, if he had lived just 30 years earlier, he probably could have been a famous Old West outlaw or lawman, but he was a sort of a throwback to the old days in a much more modern age and kind of an interesting guy. Oh, there's a lot of other lawmen that were pretty impressive people. Some of them were like I said, throwbacks to that older era. But then you have these younger guys, you know, Border Patrol inspectors. Ivan Scotton was one of them. Scotton came from a family in El Paso that had been there for several generations. Distant relatives of his had been lawmen back in the 1880s. And Scotton joined the Border Patrol in the 20s. And in 1929, you know, he was thinking about leaving the Border Patrol. It was dangerous work. It didn't pay a lot of money. He was thinking about leaving the Border Patrol, and he was in a shootout down near San Elizario, Texas, outside of El Paso. He and several other Border Patrol inspectors happened upon some smugglers. They had a pretty heavy exchange of gunfire. Scotton got wounded. And in the darkness, he got separated from the other officers. He pulled himself underneath the car they had been riding in to take cover. One of the smugglers afterwards came up, dragged him out from underneath the car, put a gun to his head, and blew his brains out. And Scotton died pretty hard, like a lot of the early Border Patrol officers did. You had a lot of famous Rangers, Texas Rangers working on the border. Frank Hamer, of course, is probably the most famous Ranger of that period of time. He later, of course, went on to kill Bonnie and Clyde in 1934, or at least lead the posse that killed Bonnie and Clyde. Well, in the early 1920s, he was in El Paso, Texas. He left the Rangers and became a federal prohibition agent. He was involved in several gunfights in and around El Paso.
How about on the other side? The side of the lawless. Were there any particularly interesting bootleggers / gangsters, larger than life characters that dropped your jaw while you were researching your book?
Well, there were some very colorful local outlaws and gangsters in El Paso during this time frame. There was a guy named who went by the nickname Horseface Murillo. Horseface was a burglar and was involved in the drug trade and a number of other crimes. And he would leave these notes behind for the El Paso cops, you know, with a horse face emblem on them. So he became known as Horseface Murillo. He was kind of a colorful dude. One very interesting character in El Paso in the 20s was Juan Escontrias. Escontrias was a police officer, joined the police force in the early 20s. But he was pretty heavy-handed. He was in a number of gunfights, some of them a little bit questionable from a legal standpoint. And in 1928, he got into a feud with the Mexican narcotics agent, a sort of counterpart of his that had been sent to Juarez by the Mexican government to investigate money counterfeiting and narcotics in Juarez. And had an ongoing feud with some local gangsters there. Well, somehow Escontrias got involved in this trouble with this Mexican narcotics agent and ended up gunning him down in front of the El Paso police station in broad daylight in front of several other officers. He really had sort of the beginnings of the drug trade on the border during the same period of time. We think of the drug war as a very contemporary thing, and indeed it is. And it would be hard to compare the gangs of northern Mexico with the modern-day cartels. Today, the cartels are very violent. They control a lot of territory. They obviously wield a lot of influence in Mexico. But where all of that sort of begins is in Juarez and in other border towns in the 1920s. You know, it always surprises people when I tell them that along with bootlegging, during the 1920s, you had a very brisk trade in cocaine and heroin and other narcotics on the border. And that's something that people don't think about, 100 years ago.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. What were the drugs of this era? We tend to focus on the alcohol, of course, because of prohibition. I think generally we think that's what people were preoccupied with. But drugs were a thing. Just listen to a Cab Calloway song.
Well, we're talking about a period of time where you had the so-called reefer madness. You know, marijuana was a pretty big deal, actually, in the 1910s. And, of course, in northern Mexico, marijuana had been pretty common among troops in the Mexican Revolutionary Armies. It was not a rare thing to find in the border towns. The city of El Paso in about 1915 had to pass an ordinance outlawing marijuana. And the newspapers always made a big deal out of any kind of instance where you had a criminal involved in something nefarious. If they could connect marijuana to that, oh man, they made a big deal out of it. Because the idea at the time was, and it's really hilarious when you read some of these newspaper reports, I mean, hilarious in a sense, they had this idea that if someone smoked marijuana, that they would become hyper-violent, that they would be sort of filled with a type of energy, a sort of a murderous energy, and they'd be like unstoppable. And so you'd have these shootouts in El Paso, and the El Paso Times or the Herald would always mention the fact that somebody had been high on marijuana when they, you know, shot a police officer or in some other instance. Well, you know, in 1915, they passed a law outlawing marijuana use in El Paso. But by that time, you already had more serious narcotics being channeled through El Paso from Juarez. Cocaine, heroin, morphine, contraband morphine. Those were all pretty common and, you know, during the World War I years, 1917, 1918, right after 1919, El Paso became a place where drug addicts would go to and rent a room in El Paso, and they could walk across the border and get their fix in Juarez. Or the dope was very, you know, easily smuggled into South El Paso and could be bought on the streets. And the police would talk about cokies and so-called snowbirds that would come to El Paso in search of heroin and cocaine. And as you got into the 20s, you started to have, just as you were having gunfights between bootleggers smuggling liquor into Texas, you'd have shootouts between federal lawmen and smugglers who were transporting cocaine or heroin into Texas as well.
Were drugs expensive during this time? Could the average American afford them?
The drugs, you know, along the Mexican border in the 1920s weren't terribly expensive. And the reason I say that is that a lot of folks that went to El Paso and similar cities, a lot of these folks were not people of means. You had people that had developed a dependence on morphine and other narcotics. Some of them were veterans of the Spanish-American War or World War I, that had developed a dependence on these narcotics to treat, you know, the pain from injuries and wounds they'd received, and went to El Paso, where the drugs were inexpensive and they were readily available. At the same time, you had a lot of recreational drug use. El Paso itself didn't have a lot of underground nightclubs, like think of during Prohibition, one of the staples of Prohibition, or like the speakeasies and the clubs. El Paso didn't have a lot of those. It didn't really need to, because right across the river in Juarez, there was this nightlife that was spawned as a result of Prohibition in the United States. You had all these saloons and nightclubs open up in the early 1920s. people danced and they drank in these, and there was a lot of cocaine and other narcotics that could be had in these clubs. The drug war on the Rio Grande really got started in the early 20s following the overdose of a young flapper in a Juarez nightclub. She had she'd gone across the river, had a pretty wild night of liquor and drugs, and died of a cocaine overdose the following morning. And that led to an increased presence by federal lawmen in El Paso and joint efforts with the Mexican government to try to crack down on the consumption and the trafficking and narcotics in that area. But yeah, it was actually it was a pretty big deal. Federal court in El Paso was pretty busy with drug cases from about 1918 onwards.
So Canadian whiskey was pouring across the Canadian-American border, but what was coming in from Mexico?
Well, the booze that came out of Mexico kind of falls into two categories. First category is sort of your American exports. You had a lot of whiskey and other American booze that had been shipped across the border just before Prohibition began into warehouses. You know, a lot of distilleries in the interior of the United States are going to wait out Prohibition, right? So they ship their product out of the country. They go into bonded warehouses in Juarez across the border. Those warehouses end up becoming a good wholesale supplier for nightclubs in Juarez. But it also, a lot of this booze gets into the hands of smugglers, and it gets shipped right back across the border. So when you have, you know, customs inspectors and other American lawmen intercepting shipments of booze in like 1920, 21, 22, a lot of that booze was American booze that had just been sent out of the country before Prohibition really started. And then, of course, you had native Mexican drinks. You had mezcal, tequila, of course, were big exports. A lot of your so-called contrabandistas, your smugglers, they were transporting large shipments of tequila back across the line. But a lot of those shipments, you know, if you had a string of mules or horses and on their backs would be strapped down bundles of, you know, whiskey bottles and also tequila, you'd have a mixture of both American and Mexican booze being shipped back across the international border. Now, there were some wines, whiskeys, and things that were made in Mexico. But the higher end product, for the most part, was American liquor.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day, 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two Colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore all of the weird little questions and conspiracies of the universe in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything. Everything has an explanation.
We hope.
But that is what we're here to figure out. We will dive into the science behind many popular conspiracy theories, such as vaccines causing autism, flat earth theory, and was the moon landing fake? And if so, why the heck would anyone even do that?
But it's not just conspiracies. There's a lot of cool mysteries that we will attempt to use science to explain, such as near-death experiences, what made the Vikings go berserk, and can I control my co-host with MK Ultra?
Wait, what? Anyway, make sure to check out the Mystery of Everything podcast everywhere where you find your podcasts.
Hi. I'm Matt Albers, host of the Pirate History Podcast. The men and women of the Golden Age of Piracy are some of the most infamous and often misunderstood characters in all of human history. You know their names. Captain Morgan, Anne Bonny, Henry Avery, Mary Read, Captain Kidd, Blackbeard. But do you know their stories, their real stories. Every week over on the Pirate History Podcast, we explore the real lives of these pirates. We examine what made these pirates sail the high seas in search of plunder and adventure and revenge. The real stories are a lot more complex and a lot more interesting than the stories most of us have been told. If you'd like to hear the stories of the real men and women who went on the account and sailed under the black flag, join us on the Pirate History Podcast.
Did Prohibition change law enforcement methods in the Southwest? Did these old-fashioned lawmen phase out during Prohibition in favor of newer, fresher methods?
Well, here's how I'll put that, Eric. Typical scenario, 1921 or so. You know, you'd have these young federal prohibition agents, and they would sign on as a federal prohibition agent for like $1,500 or $1,800 a year. And a lot of these guys had no experience in law enforcement. They'd worked as clerks or in some other civilian capacity. A few maybe had served as veterans, you know, or served in the army in France during World War I. But for the most part, these were not professional lawmen. Fortunately, there was an influx where you'd have a few, you know, old-timers, deputy sheriffs, former Texas Rangers like Frank Gamer and so on, that would join the Prohibition Service. But for the most part, these were not seasoned officers. They were young, they were inexperienced, and they died as a result. In 1921, four federal prohibition agents were killed in and around El Paso in like a five-week period of time. Two members of the city police force were also killed during that same time frame. This is an absolutely deadly scenario. It was really sort of meeting force with force. When you were a Border Patrol inspector in the late 20s on the Rio Grande, if you were going to go out with one or two other officers, there was a high likelihood that you were going to run into somebody out there on the river. And that somebody wasn't necessarily a person trying to cross the river just to enter the United States. It was usually somebody that was carrying, you know, had a load of liquor strapped to their back or on the back of their horses. It was very dangerous work. As far as the methodology, I mean, it was really about meeting fire with fire. And outgunning these groups of Mexican smugglers, pretty well armed. A group that would cross the river, they'd pay these guys a little bit of money, give them a load of booze, tell them to cross the river with it. And, you know, they might place a couple of gunmen on the riverbank to watch the group as it crossed the river. And if the Border Patrol or customs agents came out of the brush to try to stop the guys carrying the booze, these gunmen would open fire on them to try to protect that shipment of booze. So this was pretty deadly work. It was a high attrition rate. The Wild West was a dangerous place, but more American lawmen were killed in Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas between 1920 and 1933 than in any similar 13-year period during the 19th century.
Wow, that's an incredible statistic. Not something... You know.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it's typical to think of lawlessness, you know, during the Wild West. I mean, it was a lawless place in the 1870s, 80s, 90s. But there was a high attrition rate in the 20s and 30s. I mean, it's scores of officers and many, many smugglers died as a result of America's experiment with legislated sobriety. And these are officers that we don't often celebrate. Lawmen that are charged with enforcing unpopular laws, and let's face it, Prohibition was unpopular with many people then, and sort of retrospect, it certainly is now. Lawmen that are in that position are not often celebrated. But a lot of these officers died violently. And, you know, they went to work willingly, willing to run those risks every day. The way they died was often terrible. Ivan Scotton's death is a good example. Ernest Walker, a prohibition agent killed in 1921 in El Paso, is another good example. So these were officers that walked into situations under the cover of darkness. You know, most of these gunfights happened at night. You know, you'd have officers that would position themselves in the brush along the river. Smugglers would come across the line. they'd hear them splash across the river. The river, the Rio Grande, was very shallow. In the darkness, they'd maybe see some figures moving across the river. Maybe there'd be a couple of horses loaded with booze, or the smugglers would have the booze strapped to their backs in cans or in bundles. Officers would jump up with a .351 Winchester or an old lever-action rifle, yell, "Manos arriba!" And the Mexican smugglers would open fire on them. And they'd shoot these guys down in the river. They don't really know how many smugglers died in, you know, along the Rio Grande during the liquor war. It's impossible to know that. A lot of smugglers were shot and wounded and made their way back across the border and either received medical treatment in a Mexican hospital or died subsequently. And sometimes the officers would learn of these things. Or they'd die in the river and they'd be recovered. Or they'd make it onto the American side of the river and their bodies would be located. But there's no way to tell how many of these bootleggers, alleged bootleggers, were killed, and how many people were also wounded. Innocent lives were lost, collateral damage from these shooting affrays. You know, people struck by stray bullets, people who were not actual smugglers who died, unfortunately. There's no way of knowing, and that's a pretty grim situation for a law that we look back on. It seems pretty foolish to us now. But that's the sad truth of it. It was an absolutely deadly period in American history, and that's important to remember.
Was there any organization to these regional bootleggers? I mean, were there local bosses? Were alcohol smugglers taking the booze to some central location for distribution or bringing it directly to the bars, restaurants, retailers once across the border?
For the most part, the smugglers crossing the Mexican border were transporting booze to other middlemen. The smugglers would get a shipment of booze, generally from sort of a local kingpin of sorts, not anybody on a level with an Al Capone, so to speak, but sort of smaller versions of that, and Juarez, sort of bosses, local bosses involved in the liquor trade that probably had an agreement or arrangement with a counterpart in the oil towns of Texas and other places in the American Southwest. Shipments of booze would be taken across the river or across the border in other parts of the Southwest. They'd be dropped off with generally Anglo bootleggers who would then load the liquor onto trucks and into cars and transport it elsewhere. Most of the actual smugglers probably never really knew who they were working for. These were guys that were paid a few dollars, handed a gun, and said, "All right, here's tonight's work. You and three or four of these other guys are going to cross the river tonight with this shipment of booze. And you're going to drop it off at this designated place, and you'll be met by these men, and you'll help load the liquor on the trucks, and then you'll get back across the border, hopefully without running into any trouble." That's probably about as much as any individual smuggler knew about the situation. The bosses, the people controlling some of these things, they had obviously arrangements with intermediaries in towns like Wink and Border and so on. But for the most part, your average smuggler, including the guys that did a lot of the fighting, they really didn't have a direct connection with people making the decisions.
Did you find that this is a forgotten history in the Southwest? Are there plaques, memorials, etc., to remind people what had happened?
You know, there's a few things out there. You know, I had an interesting experience while working on the book, and as I was finishing the book up, I took another trip down to the border. And I went to Tombstone, Arizona one afternoon in June 2015. And Tombstone, of course, is like one of the most famous towns in the Old West. It's where the OK Corral gunfight happened. Wyatt Earp, the Clantons and the Clowrys, the cowboy gang, movies have been made about that. You know, I started my own career working on the movie Tombstone in 1993. So if you go to Tombstone today, it's kind of a monument to that mythological Wild West, you know, the part of the Wild West that's really famous. So I went there one afternoon. I was on my way to Bisbee and other places. And I went to Tombstone, and it was a hot day, but it was busy. And it was, you know, filled with all the tourists that are there to to walk where the Earps walk, see the OK Corral and so on. There's a lot of crowds and there's signs and plaques everywhere. And you can see where a lot of these things happen. Well, that same afternoon, I journeyed down into the desert near Nogales and Ruby and some of the other places I write about in this book. Way out in the woods, far away from any of the tourists and a long way from Tombstone, there's a marker that's been sort of erected in honor of a Border Patrol inspector named Lon Parker. Parker died in a gunfight in the mid-20s, in like July of 1926, way out there in the middle of nowhere, just a few miles north of the border. And I got out there to the monument that's been erected to Parker. And it's out on this little hill, and it's just out there in the trees, and it's really quiet. It was a hot day, and there was this kind of light breeze blowing. And I'm there, you know, roughly about the same time of year Parker was killed. And I started thinking about this lone Border Patrol inspector who died out there all by himself. And I thought, you know, I'm experiencing something. I'm feeling a sense of the Old West here in this place, you know, near this marker to this long-forgotten lawman. It's a lot more visceral than what I'm finding in Tombstone. So there are monuments to some of these lawmen and some of these events. You really have to search for them, though. The Border Patrol Museum in El Paso has a memorial to a lot of these officers, and there's some fine exhibits there. But to answer your question, you're right. This really is a forgotten chapter in American history. Like I said at the beginning of our conversation, Prohibition and the Roaring Twenties, it's one of America's greatest hits. It falls roughly between the end of the Wild West as we think about it and the beginning of World War II and the popular memory of a lot of Americans. But there's a bonus track on that album, and that's really what happened on the Mexican border in the 1920s. And I think, you know, we're entering this period of time in our history where there's a lot of discussion and debate about what security on our border should look like and the treatment of people in the borderlands and events that take place in El Paso and other parts of the borderlands. And in light of that, I think it's really important to go back and look at this period of time because it really is a forgotten chapter.
So what was your role in the movie Tombstone?
Well, in 1993, my father was hired along with like 30 other guys to ride horses and essentially be the Red Sash Gang, the cowboys that ride with Curly Bill and Ringo and those guys in the movie Tombstone. They needed like a small army of cowboys to sort of serve as the body of the gang in addition to the actual speaking actors, right? So my dad went down to Tucson that spring of 93, was working on the movie. Now, I'm a young kid at the time. I had just gotten out of the seventh grade, and I went down to Tucson, and I got hired on to be an extra. And my first day on set was at Old Tucson Studios, which is where they made a lot of John Wayne movies back in the day. And I'm at Old Tucson Studios. I'm a young kid, and I get picked out of the group of extras to be like a stable hand. And there's a scene early in the movie where Kurt Russell, who plays Wyatt Earp, he gets off the train in Tucson and takes his horse away from this guy that's hitting him with a rope. And as he's, you know, patting his horse down, these two marshals walk up, and they're talking to Kurt Russell. And while he's having that conversation, he turns to me. I'm like a stable boy, and he hands me the lead rope to his horse and gives me a silver dollar and says, "Easy on the green, Butch." So my first day in film and television, I ended up in like this really cool two-shot with Kurt Russell.
That's awesome.
And man, it was great. You know, when I got into the eighth grade and I went to the movies that Christmas to see the movie, and there I was, you know, it seemed like 50 feet tall on the screen. But I ended up spending the whole summer with my dad working on the movie. And before it was over, I ended up, you know, riding my own horse, and I was only 13 years old. Wore a red sash and rode with the gang on certain days, and just as a cowboy in town a lot of other days. And man, it was the best summer break ever. You know, got to meet a lot of really neat people like Sam Elliott, Kurt Russell,
Powers Booth, who was such a great guy. He played Curly Bill in that movie. And Stephen Lang, who was Ike Clanton. He's just a fantastic actor and just a really decent guy, too. I mean, it was a tough experience. It was hotter than hell. It was stressful. But best summer vacation I ever had, probably.
I'll bet. Billy Bob Thornton was in that movie, too, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. And if I very distinctly remember meeting him. And that was really before he was famous, you know. He was kind of a character actor at that time. And he wasn't really well known, but he was a super nice guy. And I distinctly remember the day he comes down the street with a shotgun because Kurt Russell's just slapped him in the saloon. Val Kilmer as Doc Holliday yells out something like, "Johnny Tyler, madcap," sort of confronts him on the street. And I remember that day. I remember that day very well. I remember thinking, what does Val Kilmer mean by Johnny Tyler, madcap? You know, a lot of those one-liners that he has in that movie, you know, they were good at the time when they were shooting it, the movie, but we couldn't make sense of some of it at the time. It was funny.
I was always so impressed, whoever wrote that screenplay. There was a lot of period language in that film. The historical insults especially were great.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There was a lot of research that went into that. The original screenplay was written by a fellow named Kevin Jarre. And Kevin Jarre was a screenwriter in L.A. in the 80s and early 90s. And he worked for a long time on that script. You know, the old script, when they first started making the movie, was much different than the finished product. It had a lot of emphasis on the cowboys. And it would have been kind of a different movie. Kevin Jarre was hired to direct the movie as well. Unfortunately, he was let go a few weeks after production started, and he was replaced by George Cosmatos. Cosmatos, in turn, the script was rewritten. A guy named John Fasano, who was also a really great writer, he came in and revised the script, and John Fasano had a love of the Old West, and he retained a lot of the stuff that Kevin Jarre had put in there. But you're right, it kind of stands apart from a lot of Westerns because it's got so many great details that are so true of that period of time. The dialogue, of course, the costuming was, you know, a lot better than you see in most Westerns. And I mean, it was really a great thing to be a part of. I'm really proud to say that I started my career working on one of the last great Westerns of the 20th century.
That's true. I wouldn't disagree with that.
Yeah, there's been some good movies made since then, but that's sort of a classic of that period of time, you know?
Yeah. That was about the same time that The Unforgiven came out, right?
Yeah, just about a year or so after, and there were some other good movies made during that time. That was sort of how I got my start. I did some other stuff, you know, right after that, and as a young kid, I got my SAG card, and I worked in movies and TV shows, and that led me into television eventually. But it was really my love of history, the, you know, the true stories of that region and the past that, you know, led me into documentary work.
What documentary that you've made are you most proud of?
In 2006, I was assigned as a producer on a History Channel special called A Distant Shore, African Americans of D-Day. And I was working on that show with our executive producer, Doug Cohen, who was also my boss at a company called Flight 33 Productions. And it was a one-hour documentary for History Channel that was all about the role of African-American soldiers during the Normandy invasion. And talk about stories that have never been told. You know, these were soldiers and sailors and other servicemen that, you know, their role had long been overlooked in this, you know, epic moment in the story of World War II. And it really meant a lot to the veterans that we interviewed. And we put a lot of time into the research for that show, and we were really proud of it. Of course, that was a documentary I received an Emmy Award for later on. But one thing I'm really proud of, more so than, you know, the Emmy I received, about 2 years after that show aired, I helped nominate one of the veterans we showcased for the French Legion of Honor. He was a Coast Guardsman, and he lost his leg on Omaha Beach on D-Day. And I working with some other folks, we got him an award from the French government recognizing his service. And I was really, really glad to do that. It was one of those moments where a TV show you're working on leads to something really meaningful for another person. And anytime you can do that, anytime you can be a part of one of those projects, it's just a great feeling. And I love working with our veterans. We did a lot of shows about World War II, Vietnam, and other conflicts, and it was really a rewarding experience. Another show I'm proud of that I worked on just a few years before I wrote Cowboys and Gangsters was a show called Navajo Cops. That was a series for National Geographic. For 2 years, we worked with the men and women of the Navajo Nation Police Department in Arizona and New Mexico. And we rode with the officers, and we got kind of a firsthand look at the modern Wild West. And that was a challenging project, but it was also just rewarding for the same reasons it was rewarding working with veterans. You know, here were these police officers that, you know, worked alone, and it was tough work, and they were in this very beautiful, dynamic part of the country. You know, they'd been made famous by the old Tony Hillerman novels, but they had tough jobs. And it was a reminder to me about how the West, the Wild West, has never really ended. You know, we think about the Wild West as being the era of Billy the Kid and Wyatt Earp. And yet it didn't really end in 1890 or 1900 or 1910. It went on into the 1920s and into the 1930s. And I can tell you from personal experience, there's parts of the American Southwest and the Rocky Mountain states that are just as wild as they ever were.
Very cool. So tell us about your website and where people can get your book.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. You can find Cowboys and Gangsters on Amazon.com very easily. You can also get it from Roman and Littlefield's website. They're the publisher. I have a Facebook page. If you look up Samuel K. Dolan, author, on Facebook, I have a Facebook page where I post a lot of updates. I have a new book coming out next year all about the Old West era in El Paso, Texas. And I'm also working on a third book that's a history of the Customs Service and the Border Patrol. So I post a lot of updates on those on my Facebook page is where I'm really active. And I'm pretty easy to find there. And love it when I hear from readers and other folks that are interested in these stories. And occasionally I'll hear from a descendant or a relative of one of the lawmen that I write about, and that's always a lot of fun.
Well, excellent. Thank you so much for spending some time with me today.
Well, thank you, Eric. I was really really happy to participate, and thanks for reaching out, and I'm glad that we got to talk today.
Yeah, it's been great. Again, I've been speaking to Samuel Dolan. He is the author of Cowboys and Gangsters, Stories of an Untamed Wild West. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.